It is good to be back with you again today. We're in the 22nd lesson in the book of Judges, and I want to invite you to open up your Bibles and to turn to Judges chapter 11, and we're going to be beginning in verse number 4 when we get down to that verse, but I need to catch you up on where we were. At the end of the last lesson, we were right in the middle of telling you a story about Jephthah's disputed heritage, his disputed past. And what has happened is some of the scholars of the past have tried to mix two stories. Because Jephthah's father was named Gilead, they tried to make the story fit that Jephthah's father Gilead was the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, which takes it way on back in the time of the history of Israel. And what we're going to find out later on in this chapter is that it's been 300 years since they were in Egypt. And so because of that, Gilead's father of Jephthah could not have been the Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh. And with that also, we found out that the sons of Gilead, Jephthah's father, Jephthah was the son of a harlot. And because of that, he had some... Gilead had another wife and that bore him sons that were legal sons. And the legal sons had just, when Jephthah was old enough, had run Jephthah out of the land. They did not want Jephthah to have any inheritance in the inheritance that they would get when Gilead died. So they had run Jephthah off, but Gilead has died now. So they did not want Jephthah around in the land. And they made it so hard for him that he fled off from his brothers and lived in the land called Tob. Where was the land of Tob? And that's where we're picking up today. Its location is unknown, I must tell you. However, because of the context of this passage and other places where the town of Tob or the area land of Tob is mentioned, it must have been located outside of the Promised Land. But still, it was nearby. It wasn't part of the Promised Land, but it was nearby, around the edges of the Promised Land. And because the land of Gilead was in the northern portion of the Promised Land, on the east side of the Jordan River, north above the Gilead land, it could have been in that area called Aram, because Aram borders on the north of the Promised Land on the east side of the Jordan River. And I'm going to tell you this, in chapter 12, when we get there, we're going to learn that Jephthah's home in the land of Tob was in a village called Zaphon. It sits just outside the Promised Land, northeast of Manasseh's land on the eastern side of the Jordan River in that area that was controlled by Aram. With that as a thought, some scholars have presumed that the land of Tob was controlled by the descendants of Asriel's mother and her relatives who were Aramean. In other words, the real son of Gilead, the older Gilead from 300 years before or 250 years before, his son Asherah, the concubine, the wife was Aramean, and her people controlled that area in Aram. And so it would just be natural, it just makes sense. Just like Jacob, when he ran to his relatives, he ran to the Aramean area. When he was, when he had bought his brother's birthright for a bowl of soup, he had to run somewhere. Where'd he go? He went up to this area. All right, just makes sense. And even in the days of Manasseh, Machir, and Gilead, relatives of those people were still living in the Aramean area, and a concubine or a harlot from that area would have still been called an Aramean of the line of Noah's son, Shem. They're Shemites, the same line as Abraham, the same line as Isaac, the same line as Jacob. But we can see Jephthah was not the best quality of a man. at least on the surface. He was a marauder, a leader of a band of thugs who came along in the package deal with this leader, Jephthah. But he would not be the first thug Israel would employ for help. Do you remember when we talked about Abimelech? Abimelech was basically a thug. Well, Jephthah's family was desperate for a leader to rid them of the oppression of Ammon. Israel was in a battle for their lives against Ammon. What could they do? The oppression was going on and on and on. And here's where we pick up in chapter 11 and verse number 4. It came about after a while that the sons of Ammon fought against Israel. They're fighting. And when the sons of Ammon fought against Israel, the elders of Gilead went to Jephthah from the land of Tob, and they said to Jephthah, "Come and be our chief, that we may fight against the sons of Ammon." No doubt, Israel was desperate. The elders of Gilead were desperate. But their thoughts were on the only person they thought could lead the warriors in battle to stop the oppression. His name was Jephthah. So the elders reached out to Jephthah and invited him to be their chief. Well, with the invitation, Jephthah has a question. Verse number 7. Then Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, "Did you not hate me and drive me from my father's house? So why have you come to me now when you are in trouble?" Jephthah's question gives us some insight into the structure of the rule in the land of Gilead. Some of Jephthah's half-brothers must have been serving among the elders of Gilead. They participated in driving him from their father's house. And now they are participating in begging for his help. His question presents a situation that most of us have faced in our lives. Jephthah basically said to the elders, "You did not want anything to do with me when things were good. Why do you want me now that things are bad?" Now, that's just the way I would put it. It is a fair question in family and community relationships. Often, those who can help the most when times get rough are those who are rejected by the establishment when things are good. So Jephthah put the elders of Gilead in a tough spot. They did not have a good answer, but they had an answer. And here it is in verse number 8. The elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, "For this reason we have now returned to you, that you may go with us and fight with the sons of Ammon and become head over the inhabitants of Gilead." Now the elders wanted Jephthah to fight for them. Now the elders of Gilead wanted Jephthah to be their chief, their head, their leader of the people living in Gilead. The answer did not answer Jephthah's question. Did you notice that? The elders were at the end of their rope with no rope left. They were desperate. They did not answer his question. They admitted that they were willing to accept Jephthah as their regular leader if he would come and lead the battle to rid Israel of the Ammonites and their oppression. And with the answer from the elders of Gilead, Jephthah made a deeper inquiry into their intent, and he challenged their words here in verse number 9. So Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, "If you take me back to fight against the sons of Ammon and the Lord gives them up to me, will I become your head? Jephthah was intrigued by the thought of being the head of the Gilead family. Would the elders keep their word to make Jephthah the head of Gilead if he won the battle? Would they? Jephthah had put the elders between a rock and a hard place. He was not willing to lead the war if the elders were unwilling to keep their word. Thus, if the elders wanted Jephthah that badly to be their military leader, they had to pledge to him. The elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, "The Lord is witness between us. Surely we will do as you have said." The elders used the word Lord as the witness to assure Jephthah that he would be the chief of Gilead if he won the battle. There is no higher witness in this world than the Lord. The elders of Gilead may break their promise to Jephthah, but the Lord will hold them to their pledge. The elders of Gilead could not turn back now, and they could not unsay their words. The Lord was involved. As we learned in the words written by Moses, it was better not to pledge than to make a pledge and break it. Breaking a pledge would be deadly. The elders had pledged. Breaking it would be fatal. The elders had no choice but to announce to the people of Gilead that Jephthah would be their new head and their new chief, and we see it in verse 11. Then Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and chief over them, and Jephthah spoke all his words before the Lord at Mizpah. Jephthah became their head before he led the battle. Jephthah had left the land of Tob and joined the warriors at Mizpah, where he was pronounced the head and chief of the people of Gilead. There Jephthah spoke to the people. If you will remember, back in chapter 10 and in verse 17, we learn that the sons of Israel gathered together and camped in Mizpah. Do you remember that? Mizpah was the campground of Israel's warriors. They were just a short distance from Ammon's camp. There in the land of Gilead, what did Jephthah say to the warriors of Mizpah to make him their chief? We are not told by the writer. But be that as it may, Jephthah probably accepted the call to be the chief of Gilead and gave the warriors a game plan. We now come to the strategy of Jephthah to end the oppression of Ammon. The first step in Jephthah's strategy was an inquiry of Ammon's complaint against Israel. Jephthah wanted to know why Israel's cousins, who Israel had not harmed in any way, were oppressing Israel. We find that in verse number 12. Now Jephthah sent messengers to the king of the sons of Ammon, saying, "What is between you and me that you have come to me to fight against my land?" You see, Jephthah speaking as the chief, as if the land is his. So that's the reason he's asking the question, because he is the chief, he is the head. And it's a fair question. Jephthah needed to know the reason Ammon was oppressing Israel. Messengers were sent by Jephthah to retrieve the answer. And so Jephthah waited for the messengers to return with the answer. Because the sons of Ammon were camped in the land of Gilead, it did not take long for the messengers to return to Jephthah with the accusation of Ammon's complaint against Israel. We find the writer giving us that accusation of Ammon against Jephthah and against Israel in verse number 13. The king of the sons of Ammon said to the messenger of Jephthah, "Because Israel took away my land when they came up from Egypt, from the Arnon as far as the Jabbok and the Jordan, therefore return them peacefully now." The accusation of Ammon's complaint did not make sense on two levels. First, the charge is totally false, and Jephthah will address that in detail in the following passage. But second, the accusation that Israel had taken the land of Ammon from the Arnon as far as the Jabbok and the Jordan begs the question, why are the Ammonites in the far north part of the Promised Land, on the east side of the Jordan River, in the land of Gilead, fighting for the land in the far south part of the Promised Land, on the east side of the Jordan River, in the land given to the tribe of Reuben? Why did the sons of Ammon not try to capture the land directly from Reuben instead of going to the land of the Gileads? In addition, why did Ammon participate in oppressing the tribes on the other side of the Jordan River in the tribal areas of Judah, Benjamin, Ephraim, as well as the Gilead portion of Manasseh on the east side of the Jordan River, when they wanted and all they wanted was Reuben's land? As a wise counselor often said to me, the problem is never the problem. Thank you, Dixon Murrah. And when we were out eating Chinese food and he would say that to me, I would always correct him by saying, no, the reason is never the reason. He never changed his way of saying it, and I never changed mine. That's how stubborn both of us were. I love Dixon. He is in heaven now with the Lord. The reason Ammon was oppressing Israel probably had nothing to do with the land of Reuben and the land that Reuben was inhabiting. It came from the Amorites, not the Ammonites. Either the history of Reuben's land had been taught incorrectly to the Ammonites, or it was a smokescreen to throw Jephthah off track. Nevertheless, Jephthah knew the true and real history of Reuben's land. Therefore, the writer inserts Jephthah's reply to Ammon's complaint. Now, folks, it is long, and we're going to read it in its entirety. And it starts here in verse number 14. But Jephthah sent messengers again to the king of the sons of Ammon, and they said to him, thus says Jephthah, Israel did not take away the land of Moab, nor the land of the sons of Ammon. For when they came up from Egypt, and Israel went through the wilderness to the Red Sea and came to Kadesh, then Israel sent messengers to the king of Edom, saying, please let us pass through your land. But the king of Edom would not listen. And they also sent to the king of Moab, but he would not consent. So Israel remained at Kadesh. Then they went through the wilderness and around the land of Edom and the land of Moab and came to the east side of the land of Moab, and they camped beyond the Arnon. But they did not enter the territory of Moab, for the Arnon was the border of Moab. And Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites, the king of Heshbon. And Israel said to him, please let us pass through your land to our place. But Sihon did not trust Israel to pass through his territory. So Sihon gathered all his people and camped at Jahaz and fought with Israel. The Lord, the God of Israel, gave Sihon and all his people into the hand of Israel, and they defeated them. So Israel possessed the land of the Amorites, the inhabitants of the country. So they possessed all the territory of the Amorites from the Arnon as far as the Jabbok, and from the wilderness as far as the Jordan. Since now the Lord, the God of Israel, drove out the Amorites from before his people Israel, are you then to possess it? Do you not possess what Chemosh your God gives you to possess? So whatever the Lord our God has driven out before us, we will possess it. Now are you any better than Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab? Did he ever strive with Israel? Or did he ever fight against them? While Israel lived in Heshbon and its villages, and in Arior and its villages, and in all the cities that were on the banks of the Arnon, 300 years, why did you not recover them within that time? I therefore have not sinned against you, but you are doing me wrong by making war against me. May the Lord, the judge, judge today between the sons of Israel and the sons of Ammon. But the king of the sons of Ammon disregarded the message which Jephthah sent him. We can gather three crucial points from Jephthah's reply to Ammon. First, the nation of Israel had in no way harmed Ammon by taking any of its land, and the land Israel took belonged to the Amorites, not to the Ammonites. Second, in verse 26, Jephthah has placed a time marker to indicate that 300 years had passed since the nation of Israel defeated the Amorite king, Sihon, under the command of Moses and gifted the land to the tribe of Reuben. At the end of cycle 3 of the sins of Israel, back in lesson 11, we learned that according to the time markers, to that point in the book of Joshua and Judges, Israel had experienced 206 years, which included the rule of Joshua. It included the oppression under the other nations, and then the periods of freedom under the judges, not including the length of time that Israel sinned against the Lord by worshiping Baal and Ashtaroth, which caused the Lord to send nations to oppress Israel. Therefore, 94 years remain in the 300 years to this point where Jephthah just became the chief of the tribe of Israel. Of his rule as judge, where he's going to judge for 6 years. With that in mind, we can look back at the cycles and include the time markers for Gideon, Abimelech, Tola, and Jair. If you look at this chart, cycles 1 through 3 was 206 years. Cycle 4, you see all of that, having the time where they're worshiping idols, we don't know that time. They're under oppression of Midian for 7 years. Gideon frees Israel for 40 years. Abimelech rules evilly for 3. Tola rules for 23. Jared rules for 22. In cycle 5, Israel's unknown years of worship of Canaanite idols. We don't know the number of years. We'll talk about that in a little bit in the next time we're together. Israel under the oppression for 18 years. And then enters Judge Jephthah. He's just starting his. Well, you total all that together, it's 319 years. We've got way too many years. The total years of oppression and freedom, not including the years of Israel's sin, 319 years to this point, we have a problem that we must consider. First, was Jephthah rounding off the number of years down to 300 years instead of pronouncing the correct number of years? Well, that's doubtful. Jews were sticklers about genealogy and times. Second, the Lord only allowed the nation of Israel to sin against him for less than a year before he sent the oppressors. Doubtful? No. Repeatedly, we have seen in the Scripture that the Lord moves much slower than man, and He gives man every opportunity to dig the deepest and the biggest hole he can before the Lord reacts. Third, to justify the time to this point of the story, our only answer is to look back at the judging times recorded in the lives of Abimelech, Tola, and Jair. Not one of these judges were called by the Lord to deliver the entire nation of Israel, as was Othniel, Ehud, Deborah, and Gideon. And as we mentioned back in lesson number 20, the writer included the mention of Abimelech, Tola, and Jair because of what they did in certain places in Israel, which did not affect the entire nation of Israel. Abimelech did his evil in his own hometown of Shechem with a few neighboring villages that his mother's relatives controlled, but he didn't control the whole nation of Israel. We can discount Abimelech's 3 years as part of that timeline of Israel sinning against the death of the Lord after the death of Gideon. Also, in our lesson 20, we learned that Tola was a native of a tribe of Issachar who was stationed as a judge in the town of Shamir, and that was a prison village. So for 23 years, Tola managed the prisoners in that town. He did not manage the whole of Israel as a judge. And also in lesson 20, we learned about Jair managing as a regular magistrate over in his home area called Gilead. Neither did he manage the whole nation of Israel. So between Abimelech, Tola, and Jair, we can discount as many as 47 years from the timeline. And that's good. So a new time would, new timeline would therefore look like this. We've got the three cycles of 206 years. It's the same as before. In cycle four, we only have 47 years, the years of Midian's oppression and the years of Gideon's rule. Because Abimelech, Tola, and Jair, their time didn't count. Israel was in a rebellion at that time. Cycle five starts with Israel's unknown time of worshiping the Canaanite idols and those. We don't know how long that is, but now we come down also to the oppression of the Ammonites and the Philistines for 18 years. When we tally that up all together, with calling Abimelech, Tola, and Jair as minor judges who did not judge the entire nation and were not called by the Lord, we have 271 years. Well, under this scenario, 29 years are unaccounted for to come to a total of 300 years. Under this scenario, 29 years are unaccounted for to come to a total of 300 years. And as such, the Lord could have allowed the nation of Israel to rebel against Him for 6 years at the beginning of each cycle. Why would 6 years be the appropriate time for the Lord to wait? Here is where we must delve back into Israel's history and the Lord's instruction for the nation of Israel. And an important instruction was given to the nation of Israel by the Lord through Moses and through Joshua. What was that instruction? Why is this 6 year waiting time so important? Well, I will tell you all about that in our next lesson, lesson number 23 in the book of Judges, when we come back together.